Hello there. Today is Tuesday, June 19. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, outrage continues over the separation of children from parents at the U.S. border.
There is no law that requires this government to separate children from their parents. That is not a law at all.
The U.S. and China appear to be closer to a trade war. A deadly earthquake hits western Japan. Also ahead, how food is bringing Muslims and Latinos together in the U.S. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, the Trump administration Monday defended its hardline immigration policy at the U.S.-Mexico border as a furor grew over the separation of detained immigrant parents from their children, including video of youngsters sitting in concrete-floored cages. Democrats blasted the treatment as barbaric, while a few of President Trump's fellow Republicans also voiced concern as the Republican-controlled House of Representatives moved toward voting later this week on two pieces of immigration-related legislation. President Trump Monday blamed Democrats for what's happening.
The children can be taken care of quickly, beautifully, and immediately. The Democrats forced that law upon our nation.
That, by the way, a false claim. This is not a law. Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen telling reporters at a White House briefing the administration was only enforcing the law.
There has been much outcry, consternation, and frankly, misinformation for many in the press, in Congress, and advocacy groups over the last few weeks that we at DHS are intentionally doing things that are unhumanitarian, that are cruel, immoral, and disgraceful. We aren't doing none of those things. We are enforcing the laws passed by Congress, and we are doing all that we can in the executive branch to protect our communities.
The outcry over the detained children resulted from the Trump administration's zero-tolerance immigration policy. And joining us now, Florida-based immigration attorney Gina Castro. Thank you for being with us. So do you have any clients facing these types of situations at the moment?
I'm working on one case in particular. When I met her, she was 6 years old, and she has recently turned seven. When she arrived at the border, she came with her mother. There were three other parents in the group, and they had children also. After 2 days together, the children were separated from their parents, and no reason was given to the children or to the parents. The children were each given teddy bears, and my client was put on an eight-hour flight from San Antonio, Texas to New York. She never saw her mother again.
So she doesn't know where her mother is?
She knows that her mother is back in the village, but that her mother is hiding because she's afraid that the men who threatened her and beat her and raped her, once they find out that she's back in her country, they will retaliate against her.
So she was seeking asylum and got turned away.
Yes.
It wasn't that she was crossing illegally. Did she go through the proper channels, as we're hearing supposedly people are not doing, according to the Trump administration?
Right. Here's the falsity in that statement that Nielsen and Trump have given, and also Jeff Sessions. They have said that if you come through the port of entry legally and then apply for asylum or plead for asylum, then you're following the proper channels. The reality on the ground is when they are coming through a port of entry, they are told by the Border Patrol that they don't have room for them and they're not allowed in. So even when they try to go through the proper channels, they're being rejected. Then they're being forced to sleep on the other side of the border in Mexico on the pavement until they can try to get in. And they keep trying to come back in. Every day they're told, we don't have room for you. And then some people at ports of entry, especially if they're Mexican, are being told, Trump says you don't have a right to seek asylum. On every front, people seeking asylum, fleeing violence and fleeing whatever horror they've already endured, are being abused at the border. First, they're being told they can't come in. They're being told they don't have a right. And then they're being told, okay, you can come in, but we're going to take your children from you as punishment. And we're going to prosecute you for federal crimes of smuggling and illegal entry, and we're going to put you in federal prison, and then we're going to put you in a immigration detention. And if you don't sign these documents agreeing to voluntarily return to your country, we're going to lock you up in an even more strict facility where it's dark, where it's even colder, and where you don't even get the food that you want.
The Homeland Security Secretary said that the people that are being separated are people that are coming in illegally. They're not the people that are seeking asylum, but we've heard contradictions to that.
It's actually not true at all. I think they're separating, we believe they're separating all families. 2,000 children taken from their parents within 6 weeks. Those are all parents. And it doesn't matter. And there's never been a rule that you need to come through a port of entry to plead asylum. They're coming in wherever they can. And when they do come in, they surrender themselves and they tell the government why they left, telling the Department of Homeland Security, this is why we left. A lot of these folks have very little education. They might not even know what asylum means. What they know that they're saying is, I'm afraid some bad things happened to me, and I need to find a safe place. So I'm asking for the United States to protect me. And that is asylum law. That is the refugee protocol that we adhere to historically. And that is the law that is being violated every single day, every single minute on our border right now.
The Trump administration is saying that they're just enforcing a law that has never been enforced, and the only way to change it is through legislation. Is that true?
Absolutely false. There is no law that requires this government or any government to separate children from their parents. That is not a law at all. It's not. It's a policy. And this was a policy that they, as soon as the Trump administration came into power, they had discussions about how they could eliminate or end illegal crossings. And this was one of the proposals, I believe. And that was admitted to by Stephen Miller, the White House advisor, also admitted to by John Kelly. And they called it, John Kelly's quote is, the name of the game is deterrent. And so they're calling this a game of separating families and hurting children. And the end goal is deterrence and to shut down the border. Now they're saying that they need Congress to act so that they can stop separating families. And that's absolutely false. What they're trying to do is push through an anti-immigrant agenda and legislation, two House bills proposed this week, that will basically kill asylum as we know it. And nothing in the proposals from the House Republicans state that they will stop separating children from their parents at the border. So it's a ruse, and it's one deception after another. And in the meantime, they are going full speed ahead, separating children, traumatizing these young kids and these families after what they've already experienced.
That is Florida-based immigration attorney Gina Castro. We appreciate your perspective. Just days ahead of the UN-designated World Refugee Day, Libya's Coast Guard Monday rescued dozens of migrants off the Libyan coastline, but five drowned. Hundreds more docked Sunday in the Spanish port of Valencia. Three ships brought more than 600 migrants to Spain, which took them in temporarily after Italy and Malta refused leaving them on the high seas for days. Spain's Coast Guard on Friday and Saturday saved more than 900 migrants on the Gibraltar Strait. Southern European countries are calling for a solution to the crisis caused by huge waves of migrants arriving on their shores in recent years. VOA's Zlatica Hoke reports.
Humanitarian ship the Aquarius, aided by Italian vessels the Dattilo and the Orione, brought 629 migrants to Spain on Sunday. They were rescued off the coast of Libya last week from smugglers' boats and were accepted by Spain after both Italy and Malta refused them. Sunday's arrivals add to the 930 migrants rescued by Spain's Coast Guard in the Gibraltar Strait since Friday.
The Spanish government has determined that these people are to be granted an extraordinary entry due to humanitarian reasons for 45 days.
Spanish authorities said they would grant asylum to applicants according to the Spanish law, and France offered to take eligible migrants who wish to go there. Germany has been silent regarding the latest wave of migrants after the government's previously welcoming policy brought into question the future of Chancellor Angela Merkel's leadership. Southern European countries are getting weary of the huge waves of migrants landing on their shores and want an EU policy that would ensure a fair share of the burden.
We must create European processing centers in the countries of origin and transit. That way we can anticipate and accelerate the identification procedures and request for European asylum.
Pope Francis on Sunday called on countries to come to an agreement while urging local communities to embrace desperate people.
I hope that the countries involved in these processes will reach an agreement to ensure, with responsibility and humanity, the assistance and the protection of those who are forced to leave their country. Each of us is also called to get close to refugees, meet with them, and value their contribution to the community.
A European Union law known as the Dublin Regulation stipulates that member states through which the asylum seekers first enter the bloc are responsible for their asylum claims. That puts a heavy burden on Mediterranean countries such as Greece, Malta, and Italy, where most of the migrants first land. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Turkey orders the jailing of an NBA star's father. The UN human rights chief says the rise of extreme nationalism is a threat to global peace. President Trump announces plans for the Pentagon to create a space force. And Afghan's Taliban resume fighting after three-day ceasefire ends. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. President Donald Trump threatened on Monday to impose a 10% tariff on $200 billion worth of Chinese goods, escalating a tit-for-tat trade war with Beijing. He said the move would be in retaliation for China's decision to raise tariffs on $50 billion in U.S. goods. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo delivered remarks Monday at the Detroit Economic Club, saying as global markets reacted to trade tensions between the U.S. and China.
We are hard at ensuring that we protect American property. Everyone knows today that China is the main perpetrator. It's an unprecedented level of larceny.
Pompeo says China's recent claims of openness and globalization are, quote, a joke. VOA's Victor Beattie asks Shane Oliver, chief economist at AMP Capital in Sydney, Australia, what he makes of the comments.
Well, they're quite clearly very strong comments, probably don't do a lot to help resolve the situation. But I guess by the same token, they also reflect the concerns that President Trump and the American government has expressed to China, that for a long time there's been a concern that China has been abusing or taking advantage of American intellectual property. Obviously, the US has done a review on that front, and that's partly what's triggered this dispute between the US and China. And no doubt there are some issues there that China has sought rapid development. There are some of its policies which I guess don't take full account or full responsibility for American intellectual property. For example, policies that if an American company wants to set up in China, it has to hand over its intellectual property. So that's what's concerning the Americans. I guess by the same token, the Chinese recognize that what they've been doing is not appropriate, and there has been moves by the Chinese to strengthen its intellectual property rules. And that was the initial agreement a few weeks ago, back in May, between the US and China. So I think the Chinese do recognize there's a problem there. The question mark is how to resolve it. I guess there is a danger here that comments by people from the US administration might actually be inflaming the situation and causing the Chinese to dig in rather than actually resolve the situation. So that's certainly a bit of a concern from a global perspective.
Well, Shane, Pompeo also said, and you mentioned intellectual property, he said the theft of that property is, quote, at an unprecedented level of larceny, and he says he raised the issue in talks last week with President Xi Jinping.
Certainly a concern there, and obviously the Americans are very concerned about it. But my understanding was that this was something that the Americans and the Chinese were supposedly talking about and seeking to address. I think the only way this can be resolved is via negotiation. At the end of the day, I think the Chinese do recognise there is a problem there, but unless there's some sort of negotiation and working through of the issues, then it's probably not going to be resolved anytime soon. But I think what is at the heart of the issue here is what's called the China 2025 objectives, where the Chinese government has set various objectives in terms of basically seeing the Chinese economy move up the value chain, become more focused on intellectual property in terms of its economy than is currently the case. And of course, America rightly fears that that will reduce America's dominance in that and that American companies will be taken advantage of. So I think there's certainly an issue here. The American side feels that the issue has been intensifying, but the sooner it can be resolved, the better. I guess I would prefer that these issues be resolved via negotiation and via the World Trade Organization. But obviously the comments by Mike Pompeo and others, and of course the tariffs that America has been escalating, are designed to sort of increase that pressure. Obviously the risk is that it results in a bad outcome. The tariffs are imposed, there's retaliation, there's another round of tariffs, as President Trump is threatening to do even today, and that the situation leads to a deterioration in world trade. That is certainly the worst case outcome and won't be in anyone's interest. So I think the key here is to negotiate.
Do you see any movement on the part of Beijing toward the U.S. position?
So far, not yet. There was through May, there was good progress, I thought, around the middle of May, particularly with the delegation coming to the U.S. and the Chinese side agreeing to strengthen their laws regarding the protection of intellectual property. I thought that was a huge advance. I thought the key from that point on was to negotiate as to precisely what this meant, leave the tariffs hanging over the debate, but obviously delay their implementation. Of course, since that meeting occurred, there was a bit of a setback. I think there was a lot of criticism of President Trump in the US that he'd been maybe too soft on the Chinese. And, of course, then the American side then moved to detail the tariffs. And, of course, their proposed start date is now set for July 6th. And, of course, the Chinese have then ratcheted that up with their detailed list. And, of course, now the US side is coming back with a further list, potentially. So all of this, I think, is ratcheting up the tensions around the issue, and perhaps the risk is that it actually takes us further away from a negotiated solution. So, yes, I did think there was good progress through May, but we seem to have stepped away from that progress in the last few weeks.
That's Shane Oliver, a chief economist at AMP Capital in Sydney, Australia. An earthquake hit the area of Japan's city of Osaka, causing minor damage but killing at least three people. International Edition's Steve Miller spoke to Scott Chenal, an American professor who has lived for 15 years in Japan, asking him about his experience during the quake.
I was having a very relaxing cup of coffee and checking the news on the internet, and then all of a sudden the whole world started to shake. And I've been through a few earthquakes here, some moderately large ones, maybe fives, but this one actually frightened me. I've never gotten up out of my chair and left a building or a room because of an earthquake before, but today I set my phone down and ran outside because the whole thing was shaking.
Now, you said you've been through other earthquakes in the past. What was different about this one?
Usually the other ones started a little bit slower. They would kind of warm themselves up before they really started to shake. This one just started all out, right, full out in high gear.
Scott, whenever I see earthquakes in the Osaka region, Kobe, etc., I always think about the giant Kobe earthquake. Did that run through your mind?
Well, and I was too, because...
Well, and that's overdue, right? The big Kobe quake is overdue.
Yeah, and one of my buddies helpfully sent me a message, said, yeah, the big Hanshin earthquake started out with a 6 the first day, and then the next day it was a 9. And so I'm like, I don't need to know that. So I'm not entirely sure if I want to stay in the house tonight or if I want to go get in the car and drive out into the country a little bit and just sleep there tonight.
Well, if you opted to do that, how far away would you think you need to go? Because you look at the Japanese reports of the earthquake and you see the Shindo map, right? I mean, there's a fair amount of distance before you get out into the 2 and 3 range.
Well, the main thing for me would be just the house not falling on me. So technically, I live next to a parking lot, so I could just go into the parking lot and I'd feel comfortable with it. There's no buildings tall enough where I'm at right now that would be able to land and get that kind of distance, I believe.
All right, that's Scott Chenal, an American professor who's lived for 15 years in Japan. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Sporty greetings to all our VOA listeners. This is Sonny Young, host of The Sunny Side of Sports. Please join me at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC, Monday through Friday, for special World Cup updates during the month-long football festival in Russia, right here on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. A new report finds civilians in the United States own more guns than those in any other country, holding nearly 40% of the estimated 857 million guns in private hands. From UN headquarters, VOA's Margaret Bashir has more.
The Geneva-based Small Arms Survey says Americans own 393 million firearms, more than the combined total owned in the survey's other top 25 countries. By comparison, India and China, which each have populations of about 1.3 billion people, came in second and third respectively, with 71 million and 49.7 million civilian-owned guns. Study author Aaron Karp said at a news conference that Americans buy some 14 million new and imported guns each year.
The American gun market is not merely large, it's unusual in that ordinary people can buy very powerful weapons that aren't available in a lot of other countries, obviously. Semi-automatic rifles being the most profound example.
Gun control is a hot political topic in the United States in the aftermath of a wave of mass shootings in schools and at public venues. Karp says such events often result in a surge of people buying guns.
Panic buying after mass killings, after massacres, is a major phenomenon. So after Sandy Hook, for example, after the Las Vegas shootings, you tend to see larger waves of public purchasing.
The Valentine's Day shooting this year at Parkland, Florida's Marjorie Stoneham Douglas High School that killed 17 has given new momentum to U.S. gun control advocates. Led by the surviving students, there's been a sustained discussion about how to end the epidemic of mass shootings. The Trump administration has said it would work to improve school safety, but has not called for new national gun control legislation. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Well, nothing brings together people more naturally and easily than food. This was the idea behind a project called Hashtag Taco Trucks at Every Mosque. But the food truck owners who initiated the projects don't want to only serve delicious food. Their goal is to unite Latinos and Muslims and fight the stereotypes and offensive rhetoric that often surround them. Jenia Dulow has the story from Los Angeles.
A small taco truck is parked just steps away from a mosque in southern Los Angeles, in a residential area popular with Mexicans and African Americans. Mosque goers and Latinos are invited to share these free tacos. Ben Vasquez and Ryder Hamida cooked up the idea for the truck. Ben's family is from Mexico. Ryder's is from Palestine. They met in 2015 and decided to do something to unite two large communities that face growing discrimination and immigration issues.
Whatever happens to an oppressed community will eventually happen to another oppressed community. And we're already struggling with people trying to define us in the way that demonizes us and demoralizes us.
We are something beautiful within each other. And as we talk and we break bread with each other and we're able to talk, we take off those prejudices that was put upon us by other people.
They launched their project, Taco Trucks at Every Mosque, in 2017. Since then, they've given away more than 30,000 tacos and fed more than 8,000 people. But their truck brings more than food. They've driven the truck from the California's capital, Sacramento, to the Mexican state of Baja California, carrying a message against hatred and racial stereotypes.
We face a lot of dehumanization every day, you know, as women, as, again, as DACA recipients, as people of color. So, again, knowing other communities are going through the same thing, it's very heartbreaking. But, again, it leads back to coming to events like these, really getting to know every community, getting to know why we all belong here and why we all have a reason to be here and why we all deserve and should be here.
Yeah. The founders of Taco Trucks at Every Mosque have thought of nearly everything. Their tacos are made with halal meat, in accordance with Islamic law. And while few people know this, they believe there may be historical evidence to suggest that the humble taco came to Mexico from the Middle East, where it still exists as shawarma. All this, Ryda and Ben say, is yet more proof that no matter the cultural differences, there are more things that can bring communities together than divide them, including a shared fondness for tacos. Jenny Adulo for VOA News, Los Angeles.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Nick Ivanoff. I'm Laurie London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Senior Director for Asian Affairs at the White House National Security Council, Matt Pottinger, visited Myanmar June 14th to 16th to meet with senior government leaders and civil society to discuss and strengthen the U.S.-Myanmar bilateral relationship. The United States is concerned about the intensifying conflicts in the northeastern part of Myanmar, particularly Kachin and Shan states, the crisis in Rakhine State, and the production and flow of narcotics. These are huge challenges, and making progress is critical for Myanmar's success overall. The Rakhine crisis in particular has created an enormous humanitarian crisis and poses challenges for the entire region. The United States has been critical at times, but remains committed as a friend to help Myanmar resolve the crisis in Rakhine State and the many challenges Myanmar faces. U.S. policy towards Myanmar is part of a broader U.S. policy in the region to support a free and open Indo-Pacific, which is important for all to succeed and prosper. In a free and open Indo-Pacific, countries are free from coercion and are able to protect their sovereignty and territorial integrity. Societies have good governance and respect for fundamental human rights and liberties, and all nations share a commitment to the peaceful resolution of disputes. ASEAN plays a vital role in promoting a rules-based order in the Indo-Pacific. The U.S. seeks to partner with all who respect national sovereignty, fair and reciprocal trade, and the rule of law. U.S. assistance of approximately $120 million last year supported a peaceful, democratic, and increasingly prosperous Myanmar. The U.S. works directly with farmers, businesses, banks, and other institutions to help all people in Myanmar benefit from economic growth. We also work with the Ministry of Health and Sports and with local organizations to improve health systems. The United States helps Myanmar to build democratic institutions that serve and provide essential services and build the skills of local leaders so they can contribute to peace and reduce conflict across Myanmar. The U.S. government also provides assistance and technical training for law enforcement and justice institutions and for education. For decades, U.S.-Myanmar relations have been based on U.S. support for peace, freedoms, and democratic reforms in Myanmar. The United States is committed to see a Myanmar that is peaceful, democratic, and increasingly prosperous. That's good for Myanmar and good for the United States.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.